Welcome. It's Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levillier, for this hour of mystery from the Golden Age of Radio. Coming up later in this hour, the adventures of Sherlock Holmes with Sir John Gielgud and Sir Ralph Richardson. But right now it's Jack Webb, starring as Pat Novak for Hire. From a day after his Dragnet series made its radio debut on June 3, 1949, this June 4th broadcast called the Agnes Bolting Case.
Pat Novak for Hire. I'm Pat Novak, for Hire.
That's what the sign out in front of my office says. Pat Novak, for Hire. It's about the only way to make a living down on the waterfront in San Francisco. Because around here, a set of morals won't cause any more stir than Mother's Day in an orphanage. Maybe that's not good, but that's the way it is. And it wouldn't do any good to build a church down here, because some guy would muscle in and start cutting the wine with wood alcohol. All you can do is try to make the books balance, and the easiest way to do that is keep one hand on your billfold and the other hand on somebody else's. Or I rent boats and do anything else that'll buy a warm winter. Works out all right. It saves the government a lot of money. But if anything goes wrong, your trouble comes hard. It doesn't do any good to sing the blues, because down here, you're just another guy in the chorus. I found that out Wednesday afternoon. It started to rain up by Pier 19, and I knew there was a storm on the way. The bay looked flat and smoothed over, but you can say that for a lot of quarrels. So I closed the office and walked down to the barber shop for a shave. The barber lathered me up so I couldn't answer back, and started to tell me how Dean Acheson ought to handle things. About 5 minutes later, somebody walked into the shop and started to tap on my foot. He got tired of that and moved up to my chest.
Hey, you listening? Hey.
Stop pushing. That's my chest, not a buzzer.
Are you listening?
Yeah. What's on your mind?
I give you $200 to follow a woman.
I've done it for less.
Not this kind. Her name is Agnes Bolton. You'll find her at 7 o'clock tonight down at this bowling alley. Here's the card.
Mm-hmm.
Address is there.
How do I spot her? Read it off an ankle bracelet?
You won't have any trouble. She's a large woman, about 50 years old, with a reddish face.
Well, that's no help. For 50, she sounds normal.
Not Agnes. She couldn't pass for 90. She'll be playing in the last alley with a woman's team called the Playmores.
Yeah?
You'll follow her out of the bowling alley. Somewhere along the line, she'll pick up a green leather bag. After that, I need your help.
It doesn't sound like love.
She'll go to the yacht harbor. Get aboard a boat called Seventh Heaven. I want you to have your boat ready and follow her into the bay. She'll leave that bag aboard some ship. I want to know the name of it.
Now, is that $200 worth?
Yes. I'll wait for her in your office. Contact me there and be careful.
Is she that tough?
No, but her friends are.
With a figure like that, how come she's got any?
They're holdovers. Now, just be careful.
Yeah, well, it sounds easy at these prices.
That depends on your luck, Mr. Novak. If it turns bad, you've been cheating.
Well, after I finished, I went down to Pier 19, and I took the boat up to the yacht harbor. I tied up near the Seventh Heaven, and I started downtown to that bowling alley. It was ladies' night, and I stood against the back rail and watched the women bowl. Most of them were wearing slacks, and if I ever get a few bucks ahead, I know the right business. At least the demand is there. About 10 minutes after I got there, Agnes Bolton showed up, and I knew right away Max Hunter overrated her. She was at least 50, because you can't get that ugly without years of practice. She was wearing a green woolen dress, and her figure wasn't any worse than a bale of cotton somebody's cut the wire on. The fat hung down from her arms, and there was so much of it, you knew even her bones were plump. And Max was right about her complexion. It was red and scratchy, as if she used a bag of sand for cold cream. Well, I must have stood there about 10 minutes watching him bowl when the other girl came up. I didn't see her, but I felt her as she brushed up against me from behind. She leaned on the railing close to me, and when she started to talk, it was like grafting a hot iron onto your spine.
You look sad, Mr. Novak. Is it the view?
What are you, the repair squad?
No. I want you to do me a favor.
You do me one.
Hmm?
Slide over. I bruise easy.
Oh?
Now, what's on your mind?
I want you to do me a favor. Don't follow Agnes Bolton.
You're pretty, but I got Max Hunter's dough.
I'll help you spend it. Don't let Agnes Bolton get to that boat.
Look, Angel, go warm up an armory. I got a deal.
Suppose I tell Agnes Bolton you're going to follow her.
You tell her first without tagging by here. Now, if you got something on your mind, lay it on the line or relax.
I want her worse than Max Hunter does. When she gets that green bag, I want you to bring her to me.
I couldn't move her that far. You better rent a derrick.
Please, Mr. Novak. It's important to me. I want to talk to Agnes Bolton. I can give you more money than Max Hunter.
You haven't got enough to cover, lady. You're talking about kidnapping, and that's a federal rap. The answer's no.
You're sure?
Unless you want to change the offer.
I hope you make it, darling.
I may.
Don't bet your $200. It's bad to die broke.
Is anybody that tough?
Now it's my turn to brush you off. Go ahead and follow her, Mr. Novak. But I'll bet you have to roll her the last couple of miles.
Hmm?
And unless you can prove it's an election bet, the police will cause you trouble.
Well, I turned around and looked for Agnes Bolton. The game was breaking up, and she started into the dressing room. A few minutes later, she came out and started down Market Street. It was no trouble following her. You could see her in the crowd. She rolled from side to side as she walked, and when she bumped into anybody, they looked back at her as if they'd been hit in the chest with a sack of jelly. She crossed the street at Stockton and went into a little coin shop. She came out about 5 minutes later with a green leather bag. She strapped it over her shoulder, and she held onto her purse with the other hand. At Powell Street, she got on the cable car up near the front. I moved up there to be safe. She looked heavy enough to tip a cable car uphill. In that light, she didn't look any better. Part of her hair had come undone and hung down in her face like the branches on a dead tree. I noticed her eyes for the first time. They were small and so close together they could have saved time and put them in one socket. Well, she got off the cable car at Geary and walked into a hotel. I followed her and watched her squeeze into a telephone booth on the other side of the lobby. The way she fit, a sardine ought to be happy. She took some money out of her purse and started to dial. A couple of people moved in front of her, and I didn't get a look at her for about 5 minutes. And when they moved away, she was still talking to somebody. I looked up about 10 minutes later, and I knew something was wrong. Her head was pressed against the phone. She'd run out of conversation. I walked across the lobby and opened the door to get to the phone booth. She fell out as old as she'd ever get. There, hey, help me get her over to the couch, will you?
Yes, sir. Was she your wife?
Well, if she was, this is the way I'd want her.
Her purse is spilled all over the floor. Sure is a mess.
Yeah.
She's some relative, huh?
Look, mister, stop trying to pair us up. I was around when she tumbled out, that's all.
Yeah. What'd she die from?
I don't know.
I just figured you might know what she died from.
No, I don't.
That's a simple question to answer when you know what
all
she
right,
died from.
All right, let me through here. Come on. All right, stand back. Give her air.
She can't use any more, copper.
Huh?
She quit about 5 minutes ago.
Who are you?
I'm not dead. She is.
Then who's she?
You better check on her stuff, and don't forget that green bag.
Yeah, what bag?
The green bag over there on the floor. Well, it was over there a minute ago.
The same one the little guy had?
What little guy?
The one who was talking to you. He just walked out of here carrying a green bag.
I began going through the phone book, but there was no Max Hunter listed, and when I called the office, nobody answered. I knew there was as much chance of him showing up as a second piece of butter on a 50-cent lunch. I ran down that Greystone number and found out it was an address out on Post Street. I walked through the lobby and out the side door. Some of the people were out of the dining room, and they looked mad because Agnes Bolton had died during the roast beef instead of later. Well, I walked down Geary to the Union Square garage and gave the guy my ticket. He started down the ramp for the car, and I stood there waiting. I must have looked lonely because Hellman from Homicide shoved up near the cashier's cage and started over. He made his way through the cars, and as he squeezed by the last one, he looked like a sea lion.
Hello, Novak. We identified her.
Well, you had lots to work with, Hellman.
Where are you going?
Out on Post Street.
I'll go with you. Her name was Agnes Bolton.
You read it somewhere?
She was a government agent.
They got their money's worth.
Coroner says she died of quick poison.
How quick?
5 minutes.
You're working him too hard, Hellman.
He's got a license. He says 5 minutes.
She was in that phone booth 10 minutes. Nobody got to her.
She looked dead to me, Novak. I don't believe you.
Well, I'm hurt.
I don't believe a thing you say.
That's up to you. I'm not starting a religion, Hellman. I watched her for 10 minutes. Nobody got to her. You better check on that little guy.
Yeah?
She was carrying a green bag. A little guy walked out of there with it.
He sounds hard to find. You don't.
Hey, mister, is this your ticket?
Yeah, it's a Blue Nash.
You better come down and drive it up.
Why?
I can't get to the wheel. The guy in there won't move.
Huh?
I don't blame him either. When you're dead, you got a right to rest.
Hellman stood there a minute, wiping his teeth with his tongue, and it began to sound like somebody beating the bathtub with a piece of steak. When he finished making noises, we walked down the ramp to the car. It was the little guy who had taken the green bag. He was hunched over and he was grabbing the wheel as if he'd just married it. Hellman lifted his head up and laid him across the seat. The light was bad, but you could see a little of his face. It was watering around his forehead and the damp hair was plastered down under his hat brim. The perspiration had broken up and started to run down his forehead like tears, and you got the idea he cried out of his hairline instead of his eyes. He didn't look surprised or pained. He just stared with a puzzled look as if he'd missed part of the conversation. Hellman stood there trying to wipe some egg off his coat and turning to look at the guy to make sure he didn't leave.
So what happened, Novak?
So he had an automobile accident, Hellman. I don't know.
He's your passenger?
He bummed the ride himself. When I saw him, he was on his way with that green bag.
Where is it?
He got talked out of it. You better check on a guy named Max Hunter.
Whose cousin is he?
He gave me $200 to tail Agnes Bolton. I got another offer, too.
Yeah?
A blonde biscuit, and she said everything on the beat.
For a total stranger, you sure met a lot of people.
You better meet a lot of them, too, Hellman, because one of them got to Agnes Bolton.
How about Junior here? Did he crawl down the ramp and die on your seat covers?
I don't know how he got here.
Well, maybe you left him here and forgot.
No, he wouldn't slip my mind. I haven't murdered anybody in the front seat.
I'll bet it's lively, though. You better get a story, Novak.
You already got mine, Hellman.
You won't like the ending.
No, but I'll bet you do.
I like it fine, Novak. You're the only lead on Agnes Bolton. I'll shop around and get enough to pin you down.
You couldn't pin down a dead butterfly, Hellman. You better look up Max Hunter and check on a boat called the Seventh Heaven.
I will, and I'll put a tail on you, Novak. Follow you all over San Francisco. He'll go anyplace.
That's fine, because I got a suggestion. As soon as Hellman left, I took a cab out to that address on Post Street, but it was a waste of time. I might as well have been peddling tip sheets in a monastery. It was a brown house on the corner, and there was a big curved window that stuck out from the rest of the house like a wart on the back of your neck. A toothy old man answered the door and said he didn't know Agnes Bolton. I was pretty sure he was on the level. He just kept nodding his head and rubbing the wrinkles on his face. There were enough of them there to bundle up and sell as a canal. I left for downtown again. On the way, I went by the yacht harbor, and the Seventh Heaven had moved out into the stream. Well, it was raining harder now, and the docks looked shiny as if somebody had given him a coat of egg white. Well, I had a couple of places to hit, so I looked up Jocko Madigan. He's a good guy who never learned that if you keep your foot on a bar rail for 20 years, it'll do more good for your arches than it will for your brain. I finally found him in the hunt room of the Bellevue Hotel.
A drink for Mr. Novak. Something to take off the chill.
No, I don't want a drink, Jocko, and you've had enough, too.
I refuse to shiver to death, Patsy. I'd look terrible with a blue face.
Will you stop drinking, Jocko?
I hate whiskey, Patsy, but I'm drinking tonight with a purpose. I made a deal with Charlie the bartender to buy every eighth drink, and I've got him on the run. By morning, I'll have him in bankruptcy court.
Look, Jocko, I'm in trouble.
I always know when I've had enough to drink, Patsy. When I tilt the glass up, the rim rubs against the bridge of my nose. It's a sort of safeguard so that when my nose begins to break out in blisters, I know I've had enough for the night.
Will you listen?
Patsy, you sound like a young girl coming home from boarding school. You'll never be on the right side of things. You'll always be in trouble because you're a bad citizen. You're a shabby half-step in the march of progress.
All right, Jocko.
You don't know the difference between good and evil. For you, all of human endeavor is a vague blur in high heels, and your vocabulary is a few gutter terms sandwiched in between yes and no. You'll never be any good, Patsy.
Yeah, yeah.
You might as well try to recapture melancholy or ventilate a swamp. You haven't a chance, Patsy. You'll never be any good.
Are you all through, Jocko?
Yes, if you're going to be touchy.
Hellman wants me on a murder rap.
Yes?
Some tubby woman died in a hotel lobby.
Sounds like his mother.
She was a government agent. I followed her in there.
Patsy, you've got to start trusting the government.
I was paid to follow her, but she ate some poison somewhere along the line.
That's the trouble with food.
I got hired by a guy named Max Hunter.
Look him up and resign. That's the best way out of this thing.
I don't know where to find him, and I think that Max Hunter's a phony. Oh, you got to help me.
Yeah?
Now, he gave me this card. His prints must be on it. Check it down at headquarters, will you? Find out if he's got a record and then tag by my place.
Yes, I better have a drink first. There's an ugly taste in my mouth. I think it's saliva.
Will you hurry up, Jocko? All you do is drink.
That's all I have left, Patsy. I'm too young to die and too old to do almost anything else.
Yeah, sure.
It's true, Patsy. When you get to be my age, most of the quiet pleasures are fattening and most of the active ones would kill me. Good night, lover.
Well,
when I left Jocko, I dropped by the Chronicle morgue to look up Max Hunter. There was nothing under Hunter. I looked through every Max from Bear back to Beerbum, and I couldn't find a thing. Well, it was close to 11 when I rode down to the office for a final check. The minute I got to the door, I knew something was wrong. There wasn't any reason, but I got the feeling. The same way you know sometimes when you're going to get the busy signal on the phone. I could see her lying there on the floor before I turned on the light. You took one look at her, and you knew she was the sort of girl whose name ought to be Pearl or Myrtle. Somebody'd sapped her, and she was lying with one hand stretched out and the other under her hair. It wasn't really hair. It looked more like a pelt or a raccoon just after a shampoo. It was fuzzed up on the sides, and on top she'd combed it back so tight it was about to go under the scalp. She began to move a little. When I bent over, she started to mumble.
What do you want?
The rent, if you're going to stay long. Here, put your head up.
Are you Mr. Novak?
It's too late to change.
Where's Agnes Bolton? Where'd she go, Mr. Novak?
I don't know where she went. Was she a good girl?
Something's happened to her.
Don't worry, it won't happen again. Who sent you here, Max Hunter?
Yeah. Please help me out.
All right, come on.
I'm Francine Kane. I came to find out about Agnes Bolton.
You're a deep sleeper. What happened?
You wouldn't know her.
I would if she's a tall blonde on the make for that green bag. Who is she?
Joan Haywood. You can find her at the Geary Theater.
She an actress?
Not exactly.
Yeah.
Her stray talents, Mr. Novak, are dimensional rather than dramatic. If you're smart, you'll stay away from her.
Don't tell him anymore, Fran. He's paid up.
Hello, Hunter. You oversold me.
You give me back the $200.
I'm going to give you lots for your money.
Don't include Agnes Bolton. I don't know anything about her.
Is that a lie?
Might be. There's a green bag.
Joan Haywood has it.
Is that a lie?
The little guy didn't think so. She left him dead in my car.
Let's go, Fran.
No, you're in a hurry, Max.
You're not. I hope you like your office, Novak.
Huh?
Because this is where you're going to spend the night.
Don't let him feel bad, lady. It must have been his turn. When I left, he was crumpled up against the desk and she was staring down at him as if she forgot to water the plants. When I rode by the Geary Theater, it was dark, so I looked up Joan Hayward's address. When I got out to her place, I knew I'd made a mistake. The landlady clutched her bathrobe like a bar of solid gold and told me Joan Haywood left the house 10 minutes ago. There was a cabbie at the corner, and he said he dropped her at the Gold Bar Club a few minutes before. I got down there about 1 o'clock, and Hellman was wandering around, stopping every few feet as if he expected to hear something. The bar was dark except for a light over on one side, and over near the jukebox, Joan Haywood was stretched out as dead as a deer on a fender. At first, Hellman didn't pay any attention when I walked in. I stood there for a while and looked at Joan Haywood. She still looked pretty, except in the dim light her skin looked coarse and reminded you of a piece of felt that was almost worn out. But the rest was all right, and Hellman came over for another look.
What did you forget, Novak?
My black tie. How'd it happen?
The bar was closed. Where were you?
Crawling out from under your thumb.
Yeah. We're going to keep that coroner. It was quick poison.
Yeah.
We found a needle in her coin purse. She didn't know about it and ran into trouble when she started to call up.
You better find this guy, Max Hunter.
That's going to be hard.
Yeah?
There is no Max Hunter.
Does she believe that?
Your shicker friend came in with a card. We went over the fingerprints. They belong to Jackie Wren. He's wanted for espionage.
For more than that now, Hellman.
Maybe. Where have you been?
Look, Hellman, stop needling me. I won't go on the block for her.
Don't you like her?
I got an alibi you can't break. I've been all over town. Ask your tail. Ask your tail where I've been.
That won't get it.
Huh?
He reported in at 11:30. You got the wrong idea, Novak. You don't rate overtime.
There, I knew everything was downhill. Hellman could stick me for everything but Dan McGrew. My only out was to find Jackie Wren, but you can't ring that many doorbells in one night. I went through the book, but there was no Jackie Wren or Max Hunter listed. I went home to get some sleep, and if they turned Gabriel loose tonight, it was all right with me. Jocko called up about 9 and said there was still no trace of Wren. Well, some mornings you can't trust yourself with a razor, so I got dressed and went down to a Greek's on Geary Street for breakfast. The murder was all over page 1, but there were so many pictures of Hellman, you couldn't tell who was dead. I was about halfway through breakfast when I noticed the story down in the corner. A girl named Toni Pritchard had been found dead out in the marina. The story said everybody liked her. The police didn't have a lead, and they couldn't find a reason. It seemed kind of funny, but when I got to the last paragraph, I began to wonder. It said she was employed by the Musitone Company and worked the late shift as a switchboard operator. I wasn't sure, but you can't pass the dice when you only got a buck left, so I jumped down to see Frank Lupo. He said the Musitone Company owned the jukebox in the Gold Bar Club, that it worked like all the rest. People use a little microphone in front of the box. They call into a main switchboard for songs. I grabbed Jocko and we got up to the Musitone Company. The guy in charge said, sure, they recorded some of the talk just to check on the girls, and sometimes the girls did it just for laughs. Well, we started through the recordings, and about half hour later, Jocko rolled a 7.
No, Patsy, they're all old ones. Try this.
Yeah. Well, put it down. I'll handle the needle.
There.
You're crazy, Jack. You sure know something's wrong.
Let me handle it, friend.
You don't get into trouble. I don't want you to get into trouble, Jack.
Will you let me worry? You get back to the hotel. I'll meet you at the Kenwood right after.
It's too late. She's coming now.
I can tell as soon as you call, Jackie.
You made a mistake, Joe. It's one time you shouldn't have hurried.
That's enough, Jocko. Let's get up to Kenwood.
Why don't we think it over a while?
Put the record down and come on there at the Kenwood. You heard the shots.
That's what I'm worried about. If that fellow's any kind of a mechanic, he's had time to reload.
I got down to headquarters and told Hellman why that girl, Tony Pritchard, lost her vote. We rode out to the Kenwood and Hellman started through the register. There was no Jackie Wren listed, and we didn't have any better luck with the girl. I briefed the desk clerk, and he said he thought there were two people in the hotel who looked like that, but he didn't know their names. Well, all we could do was wait for him to show. So Hellman and I walked down the street and slid into the car. It must have been about 3 o'clock, and for the next 4 hours, we sat in there. About 7 o'clock, it began to rain harder. It wasn't easy to see the front of the Kenwood. I got out to wipe the windshield, and that was a mistake, because just then the door of the hotel swung open. The girl came out first, and then Jackie Wren. He saw me right away, and the two of them jumped over to the curb and got into a car. Riding with Hellman's just about as safe as eating an arsenic sandwich. When we got to the corner, they turned east and started down Bush. It wasn't easy to stay behind them. The rain was hitting the windshield, and it was like trying to see through a mint julep. When we got past Jones, Hellman began to close in. It must have scared Wren too much because it stopped, and he swung the car around with Hellman a few feet behind, and it was a dead end both ways.
Can't get out now. Open the door.
Yeah. There he is, over to the wall. Over here, Hellman. He'll go down that embankment on the other side.
No, he can't. It's too steep. Stay on this side. Can you see him?
No. But he's around, I think.
You got a chance now, Wren. Come on out.
I don't like you that well, mister.
It's over there by the embankment. Can you see the girl?
She's with him.
Over to one side. Move up in front.
Oh, you're confused, Hellman. I pay the taxes.
It's gonna hurt from now on, Wren. I'm coming over.
I hope you make it, copper. All right, copper, unless you want a medal, I'm through.
You don't need the gun, then. Get rid of it. Just toss it over there.
I can't even lift my arm.
Throw it down, mister.
Jackie, please.
I'll throw it right at you. Copper! Francine, you crazy woman, you crack. You let him kill me.
He's going over that embankment.
You let him kill me right in front of you. Ah!
Jackie! Please, Jackie, I tried to stop you. I tried to stop you, Jackie.
Grab her, Novak. She's going over.
Leave me alone! I want him. Jackie, I want you.
Grab her.
I want you, Jackie. At least they can let me have this. Jackie!
It's a long way down.
Yeah. Too bad her name wasn't Jill. I saw Francine. She was lying down at the bottom in the rain. Her head was over to one side, and you knew with a little push it'd roll around as easy as a ball bearing on a plate. Her face was clean, but the rain was beginning to wash the dirt down, and when I left, she wasn't pretty anymore. Jackie Wren outlasted her by a few hours, and Hellman used them all. Agnes Bolton was carrying government papers bound for China. The four people were split into teams. Jackie Wren and Francine were trying to outbid Joan Hayward and the little guy. The way Jackie had it figured, he'd find out what ship they were going out on and pick it up from there. Joan Hayward knew he was dealing with me, so she followed me after I left that barber shop. She saw me park the car in that garage and tailed me down to the bowling alley. She planted the needle in Agnes Bolton's purse, and the little guy tagged along behind, waiting for something to happen. Just to be on the safe side in case anything went wrong, Joan doubled by the office and gave Francine a headache. When the little guy got the green bag, he took it to Joan. It was too good to split, so she killed him and left him in my car. Well, then she made a mistake. When Jackie called her up and asked her to come down to the Gold Bar Club, she bought the story. Oh, it would have worked out fine for Jackie if he hadn't talked in front of that microphone. But a nosy girl heard it and tried to put the screws on him. Well, Hellman asked only one question. About that conversation between Jackie and the girl. Why would a person say anything that private in front of a microphone? I don't know. But I told him about a couple of others Jocko and I heard. He didn't say anything, but I'll bet he gets a hold of those records and plays them every night before he goes to sleep.
An ABC broadcast of Pat Novak for Hire, starring Jack Webb, from June 4th, 1949. This is the Hour of Mystery on Tune to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levanier. Coming up next, the adventures of Sherlock Holmes, recorded by the BBC and syndicated by NBC. This next episode, from February 20th, 1955, called The Case of the Norwood Builder.
What's this, Watson?
Someone in quite a remarkable state of agitation, Holmes. And whoever it is not even waiting for Mrs. Hudson's good offices.
A man from his step. A young one from his energy.
And a strong one from his tug on the bell pull.
Mr. Holmes, I'm nearly mad.
Oh, do sit down, won't you?
Mr. Holmes, I am the unhappy John Hector McFarlane.
Pray have a cigarette, Mr. McFarlane.
Oh, you mustn't blame me. I'm nearly mad, I tell you.
I blame you for nothing. But if you don't sit down and compose yourself, I can't possibly listen to you. Well?
I'm sorry. Yes, of course, but if you only knew...
When you are fully composed, you must tell us very slowly and quietly who you are and what it is you want. You mentioned your name as if I should recognize it. But I assure you I know nothing whatever about you, beyond the obvious fact that you're a bachelor, a solicitor, and a Freemason.
Mr. Holmes, how on earth...
Oh, you mustn't mind it, Mr. McFarlane. It looks like a conjuring trick, but it's really quite simple. But he deduced the first fact from the general untidiness of your attire, if I may say so, and the second from the sheaf of legal papers sticking out of your pocket there, and the third from the charm on your watch chain.
Upon my soul, Watson, you improve. You do indeed.
Well, thank you, Holmes. And now I fancy Mr. McFarlane's calm enough to tell us his story coherently.
Mr. Holmes, I'm everything you said, and in addition, I'm the most unfortunate man in London. I'm calm enough now. But I had to know you'd be working for me. It's just that I had to get here before they did.
Oh, and who are they, Mr. McFarlane?
The police. They're on their way to arrest me.
The police? This is really most gratifying. Quite interesting. On what charge, may I ask?
Of murdering Mr. Jonas Oldacre of Lower Norwood.
Dear me.
Look there, Mr. Holmes, there, at that newspaper. Look at that headline.
Yes, 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 Watson. Pray look at this. The second page, as I recall, it runs, Mysterious Affair at Lower Norwood, Disappearance of Well-Known Builder, Murder, and Arson.
Yes, and here you see, below...
A clue to the criminal, the mysterious Mr. McFarlane.
That's a clue they're following now. A man was after me at London Bridge Station. What's that? Who is it, Mr. Holmes?
We must wait and see. Of course, you understand, Mr. McFarlane, that I don't necessarily accept your case.
Oh, Mr. Holmes, I...
Still, I'll
you.
Listen at least. And if you...
John Hector McFarlane! I arrest you for the willful murder of Mr. Jonas Oldacre of Lower Norwood.
Good morning, Inspector. Do come in, won't you?
That's all very well, Dr. Watson. But I've been following this young man, Mr. Holmes, and I want him.
A quarter of an hour, more or less, can make no difference to you, Lestrade. This gentleman was about to give us his account of the affair. Perhaps I might help to clear it up.
I don't think I shall have any difficulty in clearing it up, Mr. Holmes. Still...
Oh, it's a warm day, Lestrade, is it not? And you've been making such haste. You'll find refreshments on the table over there. I think I may say I've done you one or two good turns in my time at the Yard, Lestrade. So just let me have my quarter of an hour, will you?
Well, it's true enough. It's difficult to refuse you, Mr. Holmes. But I'm bound to remain with my prisoner, of course, and I'm bound to warn him that anything he says may appear in evidence.
I don't want anything better, sir. Thank you, Mr. Holmes.
Not at all. Thank you, Lestrade. Now, Watson. Watson.
Huh?
There's really no need for you to be learning the entire newspaper by heart.
Well, speaking of me, Holmes, this is really quite interesting.
Come, Watson. The facts. The facts. The facts.
And so I summarized the facts. It appeared that the night before, at about 12 o'clock, there had been a sudden alarm of fire at the house of Mr. Jonas Oldacre, a wealthy builder of Lower Norwood. The fire had started in a small timber yard behind the house, where some stacks of wood were stored. It was brought under control by the fire brigade without any trouble, but among the ashes, some charred remains were found. Mr. Oldacre himself was missing, and in his room the safe had plainly been burgled, and there were signs of a struggle with some blood. It was known that the builder had had a late visitor the night before, none other than young Macfarlane, and among the litter of papers round the safe a heavy oaken stick had been found, also smeared with blood, which had been identified as his. It seemed clear that murder had been done, and the body dragged to the wood stack for disposal.
Why, what could be more natural, Mr. Holmes? I got on this young man's trail at once.
And arrived to arrest him in our humble chambers. Well, well, the case certainly has some points of interest, Watson.
I swear I didn't do it, Mr. Holmes.
Yes, yes, quite so, Mr. Macfarlane. But let us take the facts first. It's true, I suppose, that you did visit Mr. Oldacre last night.
I did. I won't keep anything back, Mr. Holmes.
You better not, young man.
You knew him well, I take it.
I didn't know him at all.
What?
At least I knew of him, but I'd never met him. He was a friend of my parents long ago, but they had drifted apart. I only knew the name.
And how did you come to visit him then?
He suddenly walked into my office in the city yesterday and introduced himself. I've a place near London Bridge, you know. He said he had some business for me to do, and he handed me some sheets of paper. Here they are, Mr. Holmes.
The draft of a will, eh?
He said he wanted me to put it all in proper legal shape. You can imagine my amazement when I saw...
That he'd left everything to you, Mr. Macfarlane. Just so. Watson, look at this.
Remarkable. You'd never met him in your life before, you say?
Never. He was a queer little ferret-like man. I didn't like him much, but there it was. He'd left me everything.
Did he tell you why?
He said he hadn't any relations, and he'd known my parents in his youth. Followed my career, and so he felt he'd like to do it for old time's sake, and because I was a deserving case.
Oh, quite touching. We underestimate the power of sentiment, Watson. Well, what then, Mr. Macfarlane?
Well, he said there were some title deeds and so forth at his house in Norwood, and that he'd want me to have a look at them, too. And he said his mind wouldn't be easy till it was all settled, so he asked me to go out there.
He insisted that it should be last night.
Yes, after supper, he said. He wouldn't hear of anything else. Oh, and I wasn't to mention anything to my parents.
Uh-huh.
It was to be a surprise to them.
Well, why didn't you stay the night at Mr. Oldacre's?
He hadn't invited me. Only to look at the papers. I put up at a hotel in Norwood itself. And then, this morning...
One moment. You called on him after supper, as arranged, of course.
About 9:30, I'd say.
Who opened the door to you?
I suppose his housekeeper. She was a middle-aged woman.
And I take it she announced your name?
Yes. We went into Mr. Oldacre's study, and he was all ready for me, with the papers all set out beside the safe. We worked in them together till about 11:30.
Complicated papers, Mr. Macfarlane?
No. Rather simple, I'd say, really, though he seemed to think they were very important. We did them all up in sealed bundles.
Most interesting.
So you left him for the night?
Yes. I couldn't find my stick, I remember.
The stick beside the safe, with the bloodstain.
Oh, just my devilish luck again. I didn't know anything about it till I read it in the papers this morning in the train back to the city. I came straight on to you from London Bridge, Mr. Holmes. I was terrified. I saw just exactly how involved I seemed to be.
Our man spotted him there, Mr. Holmes, at the station. I had a fellow waiting when I heard he was on his way to his office.
Mm-hmm.
I came on here myself to do my duty.
Then you plainly must do your duty, my dear Lestrade. He's yours.
Mr.
Holmes! No, it's all right, Mr. MacFarlane. I've decided to accept your case.
Oh, thank heaven.
Now, just write your home address on this slip of paper, and then you must go quietly along with the inspector. There's nothing else to be done. I'll do everything I can to help you.
You're wasting your time, Mr. Holmes. I never saw a clearer case. However, if it amuses you...
It does. Though perhaps amusing is hardly the word. Goodbye, my dear Lestrade. Until we meet again, Mr. MacFarlane.
Heaven bless you, Mr. Holmes.
Well, Watson?
Is he innocent, Holmes?
I know no more than you do. There are some odd factors, of course. The writing on Old Acre's draft of the will, for instance.
I see nothing odd in that. It's a bit of a scribble, perhaps.
But written in a railway train, an express, with only one stop the whole way, but several sets of points on the line.
Yes, but my dear fellow...
Oh, simplicity itself to an expert. Look at the variations in the handwriting. If I'm not mistaken, this was written in the very train we are about to catch ourselves, Watson. But travelling, of course, in the opposite direction. We go from London Bridge to Norwood. Come along, let us see the home of this respected murdered builder for ourselves.
The house was a modern villa of staring red brick. We found a group of Lestrade's men routing among the ashes of the timber stack, and at the very moment of our arrival, they struck treasure trove. A few discolored metal discs. There was no doubt that they were trouser buttons. We looked in the builder's study, saw the signs of a struggle, the bloodstains, the trail of a heavy object dragged from the ground floor window to the timber yard. It seemed only too clear that Lestrade had a case. There were no other footprints but our client's and the builder's. After one quick glance through the papers scattered from the safe, it was with a furrowed brow that Holmes returned at last to Baker Street. All the rest of that close, thundery day, he moped and pondered. Next day, it was hotter still.
Ah, Watson, it's all wrong, somehow, all wrong.
You mean he may be guilty after all?
No, I'm certain MacFarlane's innocent. And all my instincts are one way and all the facts are the other.
Mm. MacFarlane had so much to gain, of course, a poor young solicitor and a bequest from the blue like that. He might have hoped that the body would burn completely in the woodstack before the fire was spotted, even that the whole house might burn down. And then he'd inherit at once.
And yet he chose the worst night in the world for it. A night when the housekeeper knew that he was there. She knew his name, even. You heard me ask him if she'd announced him. And then there's the will itself. That odd writing on it.
Written in the train by Oldacre, you mean? You still hark back to that?
Yes, on his way to see MacFarlane, scribbled almost illegibly in a swaying railway carriage, and at the last moment... Extraordinary that a man should draw up so important a document so casually. It suggests he might not have thought it very important. It suggests, Watson... Oh, see who that is, my dear fellow. This heat, this wretched, wretched heat.
It's a telegram, Holmes.
Oh?
Shall I open it?
Yes, of course.
It's from Lestrade. Important fresh evidence to hand. Advise you abandon case.
Oh, very kind of him.
Wait, there's more. MacFarlane's fingerprint in blood found on wall beside hat stand. Lestrade.
What's that? Watson!
We're done for, Holmes. He must be guilty. Fingerprints can't lie. You know that. It's the latest science.
Of course they can't lie, thank heaven. And this one means one thing and one thing only, Watson.
MacFarlane's guilt.
MacFarlane's innocence. Get your hat, Watson. We've another journey before us.
My dear Holmes, to Norwood again in this heat?
Black heat this time. MacFarlane's an innocent man. There's mercy still in heaven.
And from that moment, he was a different man. The indolence and dejection fell away from him. Sherlock Holmes was seldom, perhaps, jocose, but when he talked blithely of Lestrade's little crow of victory in the telegram, he was as near to chirruping as I ever saw him. I was to see yet another side of him that day, as we sat in the parlor of the humble villa in Blackheath where the young solicitor lived with his parents. Outside, in the hot street, some children were playing. Their voices penetrated into the stuffy little room. MacFarlane's father was away at work, and Holmes listened to the mother with a quiet sympathy.
You must save him, Mr. Holmes. I've heard so much about you and how you help people. You must save him.
Well, I think I can almost promise that, ma'am. There are only a few remaining points to be cleared up.
John would never do such a thing. I just know he wouldn't.
And so do I. And so does Dr. Watson here.
Of course I do, Mrs. MacFarlane. Things look black, but as long as your boy is Mr. Holmes on his side, he's safe enough.
I know, sir. I'm so grateful. It was good of you to call.
Well, I wanted some information from you, ma'am, to help me in my work.
I'll tell you anything I can, Mr. Holmes. There, I'm better now. You must forgive me if I was a bit upset when you came first to talk about
it. Well, of course, of course. It's this Mr. Oldacre, ma'am, the murdered man. Your son told me that you knew him at some time, though he himself had never met him.
Yes, I knew him, Mr. Holmes, when we were both young.
Well, ma'am?
Too well, sir. He was once a suitor of mine. Thank heaven I discovered his character in time.
Oh, really? In what way, Mrs. MacFarlane?
His cruelty, sir. He was more like a beast than a human being.
Oh, indeed?
Oh, I've no sorrow that Jonas Oldacre's dead, Dr. Watson. Only that my boy's been blamed for it.
Your son knew nothing about this old acquaintanceship. Nothing that might have made him, well, bear some grudge against Mr. Oldacre?
No, sir. Dad and I only told him that Jonas was once an acquaintance of ours.
And you yourself have had no communication with him since those old days?
No, Mr. Holmes. Oh, if you'd pass me that little poker box there on the sideboard, I could show you something.
Certainly.
I've never ceased to bless heaven that I married a better man, Mr. Holmes.
Is this the box, Mrs. MacFarlane?
Yes, sir. I broke off with Jonas when I heard how he'd turned a cat loose in an aviary once, Mr. Holmes. Just for a joke, he said.
Oh.
And the next post, I got this. Do you see?
What? It's your photograph, ma'am.
What he left of it. You see how he cut and slashed it all over.
Oh, a malicious character, this respected builder.
But at any rate, he must have forgiven you as the years went on, Mrs. MacFarlane, since he left all his property to your son.
We don't want any of it, Doctor. Not a penny of it, even when John's name's cleared.
Well, there may be little enough to leave in any case, in spite of the fact that Mr. Oldacre was supposed to be so wealthy.
What's that, Holmes?
Well, there's one more question, Mrs. MacFarlane. Do you know of anyone, perhaps from back in those early days, called Cornelius?
Cornelius? No, sir. No one.
I looked over Oldacre's bank statements when we were at his house the other day. There have been several large checks drawn lately in favor of a Mr. Cornelius. His fortune has dwindled considerably.
Ah, blackmail, Holmes?
Possibly, possibly. You've been very good, ma'am. We won't intrude upon you any longer.
I'm so grateful, Mr. Holmes.
Ah, it's nothing, ma'am. If only I can clear your son's name, it'll be quite time enough then to thank me. Come, Watson, back to Norwood.
Oh, really, Holmes? Norwood again?
Oh, one thing more, ma'am, before we go. I wonder if you could oblige me with something that I see in your work basket there. That measuring tape. Might I borrow it?
A measuring tape? Why, certainly, Mr. Holmes.
My dear Holmes, what on earth for?
Who knows, Watson? Perhaps to hang the real murderer of Jonas Oldacre. Thank you, ma'am. I'm much obliged to you. Come, Watson. Now, Watson, will you please take the other end? Yes, right into the corner. What do you make it?
7'6½".
Excellent.
Mr. Holmes, Mr. Holmes, I've got you this time, I think.
Have you, Lestrade? 7'6½", Watson?
Mr. Holmes, this is important. Doctor, will you look? On the whitewash there by the hat stand, the thumbprint in blood as MacFarlane took his hat that night.
Yes, yes, it's very clear, I'm afraid.
You can fiddle with that tape measure of yours as much as you like, Mr. Holmes, but you know as well as I do that no two thumb marks are alike.
What? Oh, yes, yes, I've certainly heard something of the kind.
Then will you please compare that print with this wax impression of young MacFarlane's right thumb, taken by my orders in his cell this morning.
I really don't need to, Lestrade, I take your word. But what a providential thing that this young man should press his right thumb against the wall when he was taking his hat from the peg. Such a very natural action when you come to think of it.
Well, he might have slipped or stumbled home.
Yes, of course. And who discovered this significant mark, Lestrade?
Mrs. Lexington, the housekeeper, this morning.
Oh, not the police. Why didn't any of you notice it yesterday?
Well, we'd no particular reason to examine the hall very carefully.
Quite so. I must even have missed it myself. However, if you'll forgive us, Lestrade, Watson and I must go on with our measuring.
You beat me, Mr. Holmes, you really do. Here you are measuring a lot of corridors when the case is watertight. And all I have to do is write my report.
Oh, I wouldn't write it yet, you know. Not quite yet, Lestrade. By the way, how many constables have you here on duty?
Three.
I wonder if one of them would perhaps kindly fetch me in some straw from the outhouse.
Straw?
I saw some there. Yes, and perhaps you'd ask another to bring a couple of buckets of water. Then all of you meet me on the top landing, say, in 5 minutes. I've just one final measurement to make on the floor below.
Oh, come, come. Another conjuring trick, Mr. Holmes.
Just so, to produce a rabbit. But not out of my deerstalker, you'll be surprised to hear. Will you do it, Lestrade?
Well, if you insist. I never can resist you, Mr. Holmes. 5 minutes, you said?
5 minutes.
On the upstairs landing?
Exactly.
Straw and buckets of water. Well, well, well.
Oh, my dear Holmes, poor Lestrade. You are enjoying yourself, aren't you?
Am I, Watson? Well, at least he's quite right that fingerprints never lie. That's why I knew the case was virtually solved when I heard of the appearance of this one.
Solved, Holmes? How?
Because I know it wasn't there yesterday, and John Hector Macfarlane's been in the jail all night. You know my methods, Watson. I examined every inch of the place. Come now, upstairs. Splendid, splendid, Lestrade. Yes, that's right, Constable. You just lay the straw there and put down the buckets beside it. Now, Watson, will you kindly open the window so as to drive a draft along down to the end of the corridor?
Mr. Holmes, you'll really go too far.
I assure you I have an excellent reason for everything I'm doing, Lestrade. Thank you, Watson, so much. You have a match?
Yes, I think so.
Well, then set light to the straw, will you?
What's this? Set light to it?
More smoke than fire, Lestrade. Now, gentlemen, if you will all join me in a shout of fire when I give the word...
Fire, Holmes?
Are you all ready?
Fire!
Fire!
Fire! Fire!
Thank you so much. Once again, if you please.
Fire! Fire! Fire!
Holmes, the wall at the end of the corridor. Look, it's opening.
Yes, it's a door, Watson. A cunningly concealed door.
Help! Help!
Look, there's your man, Lestrade, and my rabbit. Gentlemen, Mr. Jonas Oldacre.
I'm choking. I can't see. What is it? What are you doing here? What do you want?
We want you, Mr. Oldacre.
I've done nothing wrong. You can't touch me.
When you've done your best to get an innocent man hanged...
Oh, it was all a joke. Only a joke.
A joke, eh? A deuced queer one, Mr. Jonas Oldacre. Well, I've seen a lot of villainy in my time, Mr. Holmes, but this beats a bandit does. Take him downstairs, Smithson.
Very good, sir. Come on,
you. It was a joke, I tell you. I meant to come out in time. Yeah. You can't arrest me.
Well, I must say, Holmes, I congratulate you.
Thank you, my dear fellow. Oh, it's really too hot a day for a fire. Pray empty those buckets of water over the straw, will you? That's better. Well, it all went very satisfactorily, I think.
Well, you've done it again, Mr. Holmes.
Look, the Latin plaster partitions that he built here to make a little hiding hole for himself at the blind end of the corridor.
Yes, Watson, now you see the advantages of being a builder. He concealed it very neatly. If I hadn't noticed that discrepancy in the length of the corridors from floor to floor, he might have stayed there till doomsday and till Macfarlane had been hanged.
The housekeeper was in the plot, of course.
Yes, of course, to take him food and drink, and to put that thumb mark onto the wall.
But how?
Well, Oldacre evidently wanted the evidence to be cast iron, and I dare say that when they were looking over the papers that night, he got Macfarlane to seal a package of them by using his thumb. Then it was the simplest thing in the world for him to get a wax impression from the seal, prick himself with a pin to get enough blood, and then put the mark on the wall during last night, just to make sure, you know.
It was for revenge, I suppose, on the young fellow's mother.
Yes. Besides, business hadn't been very good for him lately. He'd been speculating, and there were a host of creditors. I saw that from his papers. And so he'd been paying these large checks to Mr. Cornelius.
Himself at another bank.
Exactly. He intended to start life afresh with that money, under the other name, to defraud his creditors, and at the same time take his revenge on his old sweetheart, by getting her only son hanged for his murder. He's something of a monster, our friend downstairs, Lestrade.
Well, we'll get him on conspiracy at least. He'll be inside for long enough to repent of his villainy. But what about the remains in the woodpile, Mr. Holmes?
Oh, an old suit for the trouser buttons, and for the bloodstains on the stick he'd stolen from the boy, and the charred flesh. Some animal, a dead dog, perhaps, or a rabbit. Yeah. Make it rabbit, will you, Watson, when you tell the tale someday?
Rabbits it shall be, Holmes. But poor young MacFarlane, no wonder he was nearly mad.
Well, we did our best for him, Watson, our humble best. Oh, it feels cooler at last. I do believe the weather's going to break. Come along, Watson, come along.
And so we returned to Baker Street. And that evening, as we were discussing the case over hock and seltzer, once again, the door burst open dramatically.
Mr. Holmes, you've saved my life. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, don't bother to thank me, my dear fellow. Good evening to you. Oh, pray be sure to give my compliments and this tape measure to your mother. A most charming lady.
She'll be the happiest woman in all the world.
Yes, yes. The case of the Norwood Builder. Rather curious in its cunning simplicity.
Now knighted actors John Gielgud and Ralph Richardson as Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson in The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes from February 20th, 1955. That wraps up this hour of mystery. I'm tuned to yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from Radio's Golden Era. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVillier. Thanks for listening.